We're continuing our study in the Beatitudes, and I'm amazed and I'm continually impressed by the fact that the Christian life really is a life of new attitudes. It could be described perhaps in some other ways secondarily, but it's basically and fundamentally a life of new attitudes. Poverty of spirit is an attitude. The attitude of heart of mournfulness or being mournful, that's an attitude. Meekness is an attitude of heart or mind. Hungering and thirsting for righteousness, that's an attitude. And so also is the one that he mentions that we'll study this morning, that of being merciful. That's an attitude. And our mercy must never deteriorate into just benevolence. It must always reach back and take us and take hold of us back behind the action, so that we not become just what the Apostle Paul warned the Corinthians about. We must not become clanging cymbals or noisy gongs because of possessing only actions without having had our attitudes changed. And so we come to this one, blessed are the poor, blessed are they that are merciful, for they shall receive mercy. And that one is built upon the ones that have gone before. Blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are they that mourn, blessed are the meek, blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, and then blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. It's interesting to notice that the beatitude regarding mercy comes immediately upon the heels of that beatitude that mentions hungering and thirsting after righteousness. Can you guess perhaps why? Immediately after saying, blessed are those that hunger and thirst after righteousness, he says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. As though to say, be careful now that you have come to the place where you hunger and thirst after right, be careful that you don't look down your nose at those who don't. And I think that there's so much wisdom. In fact, I'm startled every time I study this series, every time I look into it, every time I read them. I'm amazed at how the Lord knows us much better than we know ourselves, because it's so easy, having come to want to do what's right, having come to hunger and thirst after righteousness, to look with utter scorn upon those who haven't arrived at that position yet. And so really, as we study this particular one, the whole question of religion is brought under real sharp focus and brought into question. Because it's possible for us to be converted, and I'll put that in quotation marks, it's possible for us to be converted and to become religious and at the same time retain hard, unyielding attitude toward people. In fact, if you'll notice, one of the most prevalent attitudes of religious people many times is that of being unmerciful. And we can do it, you see, with good conscience. Because many times it's possible for us to bring in attitudes that aren't right, and then in coming into Christ or in coming to be religious or becoming the kind of people that are supposed to be Christ-like, we merely sanctify those peculiar attitudes and those harsh attitudes toward people, and we merely change the ones that we are harsh toward. At one time we were harsh toward other people. Now we've become religious and become harsh toward a different group of people. But it's so easy to sanctify our obnoxious qualities and hide them under the guise of religiosity, to where we really have not become any different. We've just become different toward different people. In fact, if some preacher's attitudes could be translated into first century heathen, those attitudes would be qualified and would be described by Juvenal, who wrote of that time, and described certain masters who delight in the sound of cruel floggings, who revel in clanging chains, and who are never happier than when they've summoned a torturer to brand someone with a red-hot iron for stealing a couple of towels. Some preachers preach like that. I hope I don't preach like that. I don't want to. If you think I do, you need to come see me after we're through and say, "Physician, heal yourself. You were talking to yourself." But I don't want to be like that. There are preachers, however, who preach and who seem to revel in the sound of clanging chains and who seem to have this captive audience in front of them, and they lash and bash, they whip and scorn, and make people go out feeling so low that they have actually used the same fierceness that the masters in the first century used as they beat their slaves. It's sad, but it's true, that some of the most unmerciful people the world has ever seen were religious people. If you look at the Inquisitions, if you look at the Crusades, many of the things perpetrated there in the name of religion were some of the most unmerciful things that the human race has ever seen. Now, in view of that fact that many times some of the most unmerciful people are religious people, it is especially pertinent to us today to examine this beatitude for the simple reason that we live in a very religious community. Well, if it is possible for religious people to be very unmerciful people, perhaps we're living in a situation that allows and maybe even encourages us to be unmerciful. Well, it's possible. And it may be that our very circumstances blind ourselves to our real weaknesses, and we find ourselves in the final analysis really and truly being unmerciful. And so it's with a sense of urgency that I turn our attention to this beatitude of mercy today. And I urge you to look inside yourself and ask yourself the question, am I really and truly merciful? Or am I one of those religious people who somehow or other has remained unmerciful in his attitude and actions? Instead of studying the beatitude itself, I want you to turn in your Bibles and to four places. Turn, first of all, to Luke 13. I'm going to mention all four of them, and then we'll turn to them as we need them. Luke 13, beginning in verse 10. Matthew, the 12th chapter, and the first 8 verses there. Matthew 12. And then turn to John 8, the first 11 verses there. And then turn finally and put your fingers in all these, if you have enough fingers to do that. Put your last finger in the opening at Matthew, the 9th chapter, beginning in verse 10. And what I would like to do this morning, first of all, I want to remind us or call this to our attention. This beatitude expresses the heart of God. Now, it may seem to you very inappropriate to point to any one of these and say this shows us the heart of God, but I believe this one does. Not that the other ones do not, but this one shows us the heart of God in the sense that Jesus, on more than one occasion, selected mercy as being that one ingredient that he uses in connection with the word "I desire." I desire. And when he talks about desiring, it says something more than just the word "I administer" or I dispense. That it's more than that. When you say "I desire something," you're opening the door and letting people look into your heart to see what it is that really you want. What do you really desire? And so when Jesus quotes God from the Old Testament, from Hosea, and interprets that into the word mercy and says, "I desire mercy," And on one occasion, he sent some Pharisees to go learn what this means, I desire mercy. And on another occasion, we'll notice this morning, when he says, if you only knew what this means, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. So whenever we find Jesus saying, as of God, I desire mercy, then we're allowed to look into the heart of God. And so I urge you, with all urgency, let's look at this and see what it does mean. Because this particular one lets us see perhaps into the depths of the heart of God in a way maybe that the other ones do not. When you look at Jesus' life and you watch how he documented what he said here and how he, in teaching us by his life what God was really like, I think you can see instantly that Jesus was right. God does indeed desire mercy. The two are the same. The life of Jesus and his claim that God desires mercy rather than sacrifice. Jesus was so different from the religious people of his day. The religious leaders of Jesus' day were a cold, hard, unconcerned group of people by and large. I don't like to make that evaluation of them, but I'm forced to, because everywhere you turn in the Gospels, there's some description of these people as being hard, cold, and unmerciful. Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan, and in it he cast the priest and the Levite in the role of cold, unmerciful, untouched, unloving human beings. Jesus just did that. He was painting them with the character that the times reflected and that those people demanded they be painted in, because that's the way they were by and large. In Matthew the 23rd chapter and verse 4, Jesus there said, do whatever they tell you, the scribes and Pharisees. They sit on Moses' seat, so you do what they say. But don't do like they do, because they preach, but they don't practice. And then he said, they bind upon men heavy burdens, hard to bear, and they won't touch one of them with their finger, indicating that they are all too willing to load people with burdens, and they couldn't care less, and they're not going to get down in there with them at all. They wouldn't touch one of them with their fingers. And in Luke, the 20th chapter, Jesus described them as people who devour widows' houses. Now, you can't get any more emotion-packed than to say that somebody is devouring a widow's house. But that's the way Jesus described these untouched, unloving people. Jesus was not like that. He was unalterably opposed to any kind of conduct that would treat people like nothing. And on one occasion in Matthew the 9th chapter, right at the very beginning of his ministry, it says that Jesus was moved with compassion when he saw the people, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. They were harassed and perplexed. They were distraught. They were scattered. He said they just simply didn't have any shepherd to take care of them. And then in Matthew the 11th chapter, Jesus responding to the unloving nature of the scribes and the Pharisees, and I believe that's the context in which it's found. Just prior to that statement that I'm going to mention, he thanked God that God had revealed these things, these great truths of the kingdom, to little babies and had hidden them from the wise and prudent. In other words, from those who were the religiously wise, they had been blinded and they could not see these truths. God reserved these great truths for those who were little babes. And then out of that context, the next statement that he makes is this, come to me. Come to me, all you that labor and are heavy laden. I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. So Jesus, in a sense, is just simply saying that because of the fact that they did not have among them religious leaders who were able to be touched and who could feel and who could gently deal with the needs of people and help them in their times of need, Jesus was so touched by it that he just was moved with compassion and said, you come to me. Come on, I'll take care of you. I'm meek and lowly in heart. You'll find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy. My burden is light. And so this morning, these four examples that I want to show us will simply illustrate what it means to be merciful. I toyed with the idea, and I finally discarded it, that we could sit and discuss mercy. I don't know that we can discuss it. I think it'll have to be demonstrated, and I believe that in the life of Jesus, we find these beautiful demonstrations of it. These four illustrations, two of them, we're going to emphasize the attitude of the people who were unmerciful. And the last two, we're going to emphasize the attitude of the Lord, who was truly, completely merciful. But these two, and we'll use them in contradistinction to each other, and we'll see if we can't ourselves get caught in between them so that we can find out whether we're merciful or not, or perhaps are unmerciful. The first one of these is Luke, the 13th chapter. In this particular incident, Jesus was in the synagogues one Saturday, and there was a woman there who was bent over double. She couldn't raise up. She had been that way for 18 years. And Jesus was touched so that he could not stand it. He could not allow her to go on like that anymore. And so he laid his hands upon her and told her, "Woman, you're freed from your infirmity." Oh. Of course, the people were thrilled. And it says so in the last verse there. As he said this, all of his adversaries were put to shame, and all the people rejoiced at all the glorious things that were done by him. They were thrilled that he would take this opportunity, even though it was the Sabbath day, to heal this woman of her infirmity. It was the Sabbath day. And this hypocrite of a ruler stood up and made an announcement and said, "Now, there are 6 days in which men ought to work. You come on those days and be healed, and not on the Sabbath." And Jesus literally was, well, I don't know how to describe it. It doesn't describe it here. On one other occasion, it says that he looked about upon them with anger because of their hardness of heart in a similar situation. But he says here, "You're quite wrong. You're wrong in acting like you're acting." And he showed them that not only were they inhumane, and they were, but he shows them that they were inconsistent. When he turned to this man and said, "You hypocrite, do you not on the Sabbath day take your own ox or your ass and loose him from the stall and lead him away to water him? Should not this woman, who is a daughter of Abraham, who has been bound by Satan for lo these 18 years, be loosed on the Sabbath day?" And that's what made, that says they were put to shame, and the people just rejoiced at all the glorious things he was doing. Jesus showed that these men were not only inhumane, they were inconsistent. Now watch the principle. These men who condemned him for doing good on the Sabbath day were inconsistent in the sense that they were condemning in Jesus the same thing that they were allowing in themselves. Oh. He said, "Look, you've condemned me for doing good on the Sabbath day to this woman. Tell me, which of you does not loose his own ox or ass and lead him away to water him on the Sabbath?" So he showed them, what you're condemning in me, you're accepting and condoning in yourself. So on another occasion, he said, "It's right and lawful to do good on the Sabbath day." But does that ring a bell with you? Before we go and make an application, let me say this, that the real point here is not the fact that this man quoted the law. Oh, he referred to Exodus 20 and verse 8 and 9, where God says, 6 days shall you labor. On the Sabbath day, you shall not do any labor. But these men, this man in particular, made a mistake in that he failed to look at the law through the eyes of the lawgiver. The lawgiver gave a law for the benefit of man. And on another occasion, Jesus says the law or the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The Pharisee had forgotten and had thought that actually man was made for the gratification of the Sabbath. Jesus says that's not the purpose of it at all. But here was the real crux of the matter. And it's contained in a little word that is simply indignant. Indignant. It says that when the ruler saw what had happened, he was indignant. Now, the word indignant reaches down into your feelings also. It reaches down and describes something that happens way deep down inside you, much deeper than just actions. Had the man said, "Now there are 6 days in which men ought to work, and on that day you should come and be healed," that's one thing. But for him to have seen a good deed done to a woman who'd been bound for 18 years, and then to become indignant over it, that simply said this man's heart was not right. It wasn't in the right place. And that's why Jesus turned to him and said, "You hypocrite, condemning in other people what you accept in yourself, and in view of the light, and in view of this woman's plight, you actually condemn me for loosing her on the Sabbath. When you treat your own dogs, your own cattle the same way, you loose them on the Sabbath." How many times do you and I do things and condone them in ourselves, but condemn them in other people? Well, anybody that's driven a car has done that. You can't drive a car. There's something that happens to a person when he gets behind a wheel. He loses himself. You know, he thinks there's nobody can see him. And sometimes we act awful. Just act terrible. Did you ever pull up to a street, you know, did you ever turn into a street? Somebody else is coming to the stop sign, and you pull in a little bit ahead of them, and you kind of cut it short. So they have to put on their brake fast because you come around that corner a bit, you cut it a bit thin. And, you know, you can see them go. And, boy, do they ever stare you down. You think, well, what's the matter with that character? Good grief. And then two blocks down, you come to a stop sign, and here comes somebody in front of you. And you have to stop your car because he's cut the thing too thin. And you know what you do? Just stare a hole in him. Why? Sure. It's all right as long as you're the one that's staring and he's the one that's doing the cut and thin. But let him do that, and that just doesn't work. Condemn him. And yet, if you're not careful, you'll do the same thing yourself that you are condoning or condemning in him. You children, before you condemn your mother or judge her harshly for becoming upset with you when she calls you to dinner, here's a mother now that's been working for 2 hours getting dinner ready, and she can't get anybody to come to the table. And she calls and calls, you know, and they're in there playing guitars and singing or watching TV, and she gets kind of uptight. Will you please come? This is the last call. Well, before you get all upset with the way she acts toward you, let me urge you to do what one of our daughters did last Friday, or yesterday it was. She cooked a meal for the family, and she couldn't get anybody to come to the table. Oh, they were in there playing guitars and all that. She just couldn't get them to come. I think she sees her mother in a different light. Don't condemn in other people what you condone or overlook in yourself. But let's look at another one. Turn to Matthew, the 12th chapter. In this instance here, Jesus was walking with his disciples through a grain field. And they began, being hungry as they were, they began to pluck some of the grains of wheat off of the ear, rub that husk off, blow it away, and began to eat. The Pharisees were very quick to take up on that, and they said, look at them doing what is not lawful for people to do on the Sabbath day. And so they condemned people for fulfilling natural human needs on the Sabbath day. And Jesus was right in the middle of it. What was he going to say? Well, once again, these people referred to the law that it's not lawful to do what they're doing on the Sabbath day. And again, their failure was that they had never looked at the people or the law through the eyes of the lawgiver, God, because had they looked at the law through that, and had they looked at the people through that perspective, they never would have condemned the guiltless. Now, if you'll look at verse 7, this is exactly what Jesus says. Whenever he told them and corrected them, of course, first of all, they were also inconsistent. You see, whereas the people that he referred to in Luke, the 13th chapter, were excusing in themselves what they were condemning in others, here Jesus shows that these people were condemning in their enemies what they were excusing in their friends. Look at what they said in verse 3. Matthew 12, after they condemned him, he said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he entered into the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it's not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests." Well, but he was David. And they wouldn't think about criticizing David. He was one of the patriarchs. He was one of their forefathers. He was one of their friends. Well, Jesus says, you're condemning in us exactly the same thing that you excuse in David. And that's a principle, too. How many times do we find ourselves doing that? You know, there's some people who, in our eyes, just can't do any wrong. You have anybody like that? There are people that, I mean, anybody other than your children. Your children are a lot like that when they're out. Now, when they're with you, they do a lot of things wrong because they irritate you and all, but I don't think you can grow up without irritating your parents. I'm beginning to realize that. But what do you do? Whose side do you take whenever your children are criticized by other people? For example, when some teacher comes to you and says, your child is misbehaving in school, whose side do you take? Well, it's awfully difficult to take the teacher's side and say, well, I'll see to it that he doesn't do that again. It's awfully difficult to even look at that criticism objectively because we have a tendency, and by the way, it exists here in this community, we have a tendency to look very critically at any teacher who would go contrary to little Johnny, and whether it's in class or on the football field or on the basketball court, if something doesn't go just quite right, will almost invariably take Johnny over the teacher or over the coach. Now, that's happened. Do you ever do that? There are some people who just can't do anything wrong in our eyes, and other people that they just can't do anything right. This particular principle here that Jesus shows, as he demonstrates mercy, he was showing how that condemning in your enemies what you condone in your friends, that's not right. But look, he said in verse 7, if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would have not condemned the guiltless. The real issue was here again. What did they really and truly want? It wasn't a matter of their making a judgment. We're going to make a judgment of everything. Unless you're completely zonked and out of your head and out to lunch, you're going to make a judgment of right or wrong, good or bad, of everything that you see. Now, he says, if you men had had your head on right, if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you wouldn't have made the judgment that you made. So actually what he was saying was, again, your heart isn't right. You're not looking at this through the eyes of the lawgiver. He never intended to deprive people of their human needs. That wasn't the purpose of the law. The law, or the Sabbath, was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. But let's look at a principle. This is a side. It's not a side either, but you haven't got a finger in it. I figured you didn't have enough fingers. Let me, in John the 7th chapter and verse 24, a similar situation where Jesus was condemned for healing somebody on the Sabbath. John 7:24, they condemned him for this healing. He then showed them again they were inconsistent. He said, you'll take somebody and circumcise him on the Sabbath, and you don't say anything about that. Why then do you condemn me for making a man completely well on the Sabbath? What's the difference? Well, there wasn't any difference except that Jesus was doing more good than a person who was circumcised on the Sabbath day was doing. But then he makes this statement, do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. Now, what do you mean by judge by appearances? That means don't make hasty decisions. Don't make hasty judgments. Don't just judge on the surface. Get both sides of the question. How many of you would have avoided a very embarrassing situation had you listened to both sides before you made a statement indicating guilt? I'd have to raise my hand, because I've been embarrassed before. Sometimes women would come into my office to be counseled and to talk and about their marriage. And they spill out all this, that their husbands are doing. And I would end up just, gritting my teeth, wanting to just go whip him. Anybody that would do that to a woman ought to be whipped. Then I gradually realized that, there are two sides to every story. And if you'll just go talk to old John and sit down with him and say, now look, what is the problem? I guarantee you, he'll give you at least a different vantage point from which to look at it. There are always two sides to every story, and then usually there's the truth in addition to those two sides. Judge righteous judgment. Judge right. Quit making these surface judgments. It's just simply not right. But the key to both of these is simply this. Do you really and truly desire mercy? Jesus says, if you really knew what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would have made the proper judgment. And if that isn't the way we make judgments today, you're going to always find yourself caught out, because your own heart will really condemn you for not judging out of mercy and for judging critically. Well, there are two examples, though, that are good and are positive. Look at John, the 8th chapter. John 8, 1 through 11, you know the story. The woman taken in adultery was brought into Jesus, and I've mentioned her so much, I feel like we're almost abusing her. But it's such a beautiful story, and I find so many lessons in it. The dynamic of the gospel is there. The dynamic of forgiveness is here. The woman was taken, brought in to Jesus, thrown into the midst of these people. You know how they said, now the law says kill her. Here again, they mention the law. The law says stone her. What do you say, Jesus? And so they were willing to make this critical judgment of this woman. Jesus was put on the spot because here, actually, there was a law that had been broken. And these people had caught her in the act, and they were now bringing her to Jesus to get him to condone and endorse their judgment. How does a person endorse or condone the critical judgment of people, or how does he escape such critical judgment? How can he get out of it? Well, Jesus was a master at not letting anybody put him in a box. He stooped down and began to write in the sand, and what the reason for, I don't know. But nevertheless, he did this. Whatever was his intention, what happened was that it took their attention off of the woman and put it upon Jesus. And I suspect that they began to think that Jesus did not know the answer to the question. But that's all right. Jesus demonstrates something here that's necessary if you're going to deal with mercy with people. And that is, you must be willing to take the brunt of it yourself and let the one who's guilty off the hook. That's what you find in this account here in John, the 8th chapter. He was willing to accept the brunt of the criticism because they turned from criticizing her and started badgering Jesus and saying to him, "Look, give us an answer. What do you say about it?" And then he said, "Well, let him that's without sin among you cast the first stone." And he stooped back down and wrote again in the sand. And then he raised up and said, "Woman, where are your accusers? Do you have none?" She said, "No, Lord." He said, "Neither do I condemn you. You go on now and don't you sin anymore." These statements are important. But here again, I believe it's the action of Jesus that's important. He was saying to them, "I'm willing to take the brunt. I'm willing to take the criticism. I'm willing to forego coming off smelling like a rose so that the guilty party might be forgiven." Now I want to ask you a question. What do you do and what do I do when somebody has actually sinned against you? It's not a matter of interpretation. It's not a matter of anything except they've been caught red-handed. And you've got them. There they are. What is your attitude toward them? Well, how do you feel? Now, you've got two options. You can either do like the Pharisees did, come quoting the law and demanding that she be punished, or you can do like Jesus. What was it that Jesus did? Here it is. Jesus looked hard for a way to forgive this one that was wrong and then lead her to a higher calling in life. He looked hard for that. I don't know whether this scribbling in the sand, I don't know what it was. We'll just have to leave it like it is. But Jesus searched for a way to show mercy to this woman. He searched for a way for mercy to show forgiveness. And it was his desire. Now, why would he do that? Because it was his desire. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. The Pharisees and Sadducees, they were wanting to sacrifice this woman. Jesus said, "Wait a minute, now there's a better way than that. Let's look for mercy." Now watch what he did not do. He did not condone what she did. He said, essentially, "What you've done is sin." He said, "Go your way and don't sin anymore," implying that what you've already done is sin. But he looked for a way to forgive her and lead her to a higher life. Now listen, mercy always looks for a way to forgive and lead to a higher life. It looks for a way. Now, when you find people are really and truly caught in the middle and you have power over them and it's your decision whether you do one thing or the other, what do you really and truly like to do? What do you desire to do? Last Sunday, a Christian woman, a lovely Christian woman, came afterwards and said, "You've been reading my mail." We were speaking on meekness. She said, "You've been reading my mail and the ability of a person who is meek to forego his rights in order to fill somebody else's needs." And she was saying, "I just found myself this very week. Somebody was," and she said, "I just simply had a right to do it." And she said, "And I did it, and it felt so good doing it." Oh, and she confessed it, you know, to me and to her. And she knew, she said, "Why is that?" Well, it's always difficult to keep yourself pushed down out of the way. We want those rights, you know, we want to let that thing come up and selfishness take charge. Well, in this condition here, in this circumstance, what is your real desire? Do you really feel good when you rub a person's nose in, you know, just, or do you really feel good when you look for a way and say, "Let me see, I know you did wrong, but let's forgive that and figure out a way to get it." What makes you really feel good? I suspect when you find out what you really desire, you'll know whether or not you're really merciful or not. Well, there's finally one, and this is important, and turn to Matthew the 9th chapter, and we'll look at that briefly. Matthew 9, Jesus had just called the tax collector Matthew. And it's similar to the way that he called Zacchaeus. He took the initiative. In both of these, he did not have to be associated with these people. He could have been associated with somebody else. But in the case of both of these men, Jesus chose to associate with both of these tax collectors. One became one of the 12, and one just became a disciple. The question at stake here is this: what is your attitude toward sinners? How do you express disapproval of sin and get this message across to the sinner? How do you express this disapproval? Well, there are two options. One is you can express it like the Pharisees did. The other, you can express it like Jesus did. The Pharisees expressed disapproval by rejection of the sinner and withdrawal from him. That's right. In fact, that's why they were named Pharisees. It means that those who are separated. They named themselves, I guess. They wore it proudly enough. But that's what their word, their name means, to separate. The Pharisees, the separated ones. And that's the only key, that's the only dynamic that their religion had going for them at the time that Jesus came into the scene. They expressed disapproval of sin by rejecting the sinner and withdrawing from him. Now listen to this. Jesus came and he also disapproved of sin. But watch what he did. He had an ambivalence about him that was just unearthly. Jesus had the ability to show disapproval for sin and at the same time accept the sinner. I don't know how he did it. It's very difficult, and I can just barely even distinguish and see what he did do. But I can tell you how I can tell you when he did it. I can't necessarily tell you how. He disapproved of sin while at the same time he received people who were sinners and made them feel like that they were accepted. But he just had the ability to do it. How do we do it? Well, a man told me yesterday at the grocery store, a man with whom I've had limited contact, though some contact, and he hasn't been attending the worship services of the church like he should. And I said, "I've been missing you." And he said, "Well," he said, "I just thought that you were mad at me because I was drinking the day we worked together." I said, "Oh, man, no." But what I wondered after I left him, I wondered, did I communicate to him when he was working with me? Did I communicate rejection to him? If I did, then I've missed the dynamic of the gospel of Christ. I've missed that dynamic that takes the world where the Lord finds them in a mess and judges the sin, but frees the sinner. Doesn't approve of the sin, but loves the sinner. And if we can learn that basic principle, we're going to see one of the dynamics of the gospel of Christ. What do you really enjoy doing? What do you love? What do you desire? Now God says, "I desire mercy, not sacrifice." These two negative qualities that are wrong, condemning in other people what we excuse in ourselves, condemning in our enemies what we excuse or overlook in our friends, and then these two attitudes of the Lord that are right, and that is looking for a way to forgive the sinner and lead him to a higher life, and then disapproving of sin while accepting the sinner. These are two very pertinent and important attitudes in relationship to mercy. How do you go about your life? I think if you can ever determine these two things, do you treat sinners like that? And how do you judge those who have offended you? If you can determine these two things, as we've noticed in these four examples, perhaps we can see whether or not we're merciful. Whenever the choice is yours, what do you do? What really makes you feel good? Being judgmental or being merciful? It's these people that Jesus refers to when he says, "Happy are the merciful, for they'll obtain mercy." This is the mind of God. It lets us look into the heart of God. And if we have the heart of God, then we ourselves will be merciful and we'll find ourselves wanting it and desiring it. Today, if you're here and you're not a Christian, then you need the mercy of God, and it's ample and full and free. Come confessing your faith in him. Be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins. The blood of Jesus will cleanse you from every sin by his mercy and his grace. If you're here and you're a Christian and you've been unmerciful to people, look at your heart and let's turn and change. And if you need to make some public statement, if it's been so obvious that it's brought reproach on the church, you may wish to make some statement. May God bless us to become merciful. Let us stand and sing.